Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasige. It was a dream come true for Badgewanna First Nation members in Ontario who celebrated the return of their ancestors' remains in a repatriation ceremony. A former Nipissing University student is sending back his diploma after the school named its library after former Ontario Premier Mike Harris. The Canada Council for Aboriginal Business is looking for nominations for its next round of inductees into the Aboriginal Business Hall of Fame, and a 12-year-old boy in southern Ontario has entered his charitable idea into the Pepsi Refresh Everything contest to build a $25,000 playground for the children in Attawapiskat. And voting for the final round of the Aboriginal People's Music Choice Awards is just around the bend. All these stories plus great tunes all coming your way after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. CBC has reported some Aboriginal communities in northern Saskatchewan are interested in the possibility of storing nuclear waste. But that's something the province hasn't made up its mind about yet. Representatives from the Métis village of Pinehouse visited the Nuclear Waste Management Organization in Toronto last week. Nuclear fuel is stored at reactor sites throughout the country. However, the organization is looking for a community to host a national storage facility. Jamie Robinson, a spokesperson for the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, told CBC that a few Métis towns and First Nations in Saskatchewan have heard presentations. To be chosen, the Métis community or First Nation would have to pass a resolution expressing interest in the plans. Robinson said some Aboriginal communities in Saskatchewan are in the first stages of being placed on the eligibility list, so it wouldn't be fair to say which ones have been spoken with. Meanwhile, the provincial government doesn't step into the process until proposals are well into the regulatory process. The organization has only one formal application to host a nuclear waste storage site, and that's from Northern Ontario. Assembly of First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo has added his voice, calling for a public inquiry into the Picton case. The National Chief said in a statement, many of the victims were First Nations and Aboriginal women, and a full and comprehensive public inquiry with the participation of Aboriginal people is the only way to address the need for respect, justice, and a better understanding of how we can prevent these tragedies in the future. Other groups calling for the public inquiry include the families of the missing and murdered women, Vancouver Police, RCMP, Civil Liberties Association, and Union of BC Indian Chiefs and Amnesty International. The Times Colonist has reported the BC government has delayed its decision for a public inquiry so Attorney General Mike DeYoung can read the Vancouver Police and RCMP internal reviews of the case. The government has also added that an inquiry would have to be approved by Cabinet, which does not meet again until next month. An inquiry would attempt to zero in on the police failure to nab Picton far sooner and prevent the deaths of more than a dozen women. Robert Picton was charged with murdering 26 women whose body parts were found on his farm in Port Coquitlam and convicted on 6 accounts in late 2006. Meanwhile, the Crown has stayed another 20 charges after the Supreme Court rejected Picton's bid for a new trial. In Ontario, Batchewana First Nation members have held a repatriation ceremony. The remains of six ancestors of more than 200 years old arrived in the community from the Smithsonian Institute in Washington. Chief Dean Sayer says the remains were taken in the late 1800s.
The remains were collected by U.S. Assistant Surgeon Joseph King, 1875, and they had to have been dug up. That's what we figure. They weren't recent graves. They were graves that, on the most part, were between 50 and 100 years, but one was only about 10 years old. So they were probably deaths that took place somewhere in the late 1700s. And by the time they dug them up in 1875, they were already possibly up to 100 years old. And then since then, it's been another 130 years since then, so it's really hard for us to, our elders have any recollections of any particulars around the depths of those individuals, what was happening, nor were they aware of any theft of remains in the 1870s, so we're not sure how they would have done it without us knowing. I guess they might have did it under cover of night, but I don't have that information.
Sayer says the repatriation process actually began about 6 years ago. He says community elders have been a lot of help for the repatriation ceremony.
We have a number of our cultural people in our community, including former chief and elder Harvey Bell. We also have the cultural repatriation specialist from the Sioux Tribe helping us. We also have our own ceremony makers in our community, some of our elders that are guiding us and need to make sure we incorporate into the final process that we're working on here. So it's through a lot of engagement with our elders.
The remains were buried August 19th in a site overlooking Lake Superior. Meanwhile, in the northern Lake Superior region, Anishinaabeg leadership upset over not having been consulted over the thousands of artifacts that have been dug up and shipped to Lakehead University. The artifacts are reported to be about 9,000 years old and is being called the most significant archaeological finds in northern Ontario. In a statement, Anishinaabeg Nation Grand Council Chief Patrick Madhabi said it has become common knowledge in Canada, especially Ontario, that First Nations have a significant connection to history and the artifacts represent the history of the people and relationship to the land. The Grand Council Chief said it doesn't matter that the artifacts may not belong to the specific Indigenous people that reside in the Lake Superior region today. What's important that the area First Nations today have been consulted and engaged in the process. Madhabi points out that the Ipperwash Inquiry recommendations included heritage and burial site recommendations. In just a few months from now, the Nishga will be embarking on new ground. A new Nishga law will be taking effect in October, which will allow for private land ownership on parts of their territory. The Post Media News reports that many leaders are wary of the new law, as the Nishga will become the first First Nations government in the country to allow individuals, native and non, to own homes, raise mortgages, and buy and sell property on First Nations land. Some First Nations leaders are worried that private ownership would diminish what little land-based First Nation communities have left. But the paper also reports Manny Jules, Chief Commissioner of the First Nations Tax Commission, has argued for years that property holds the key to unlocking prosperity and solving the social problems that plague so many First Nation communities. Environmental groups have joined with First Nations in Alberta in a call to protect caribou herds. The groups are urging the federal government to provide emergency protection for caribou herds in northeastern Alberta. The environmental groups filed a letter earlier this week calling for a halt to further industrial activity in caribou ranges until a recovery plan and habitat protection measures mandated by species legislation is put in place. The letter echoes a demand made by First Nations a month ago when the Beaver Lake Cree Nation, Enoch Cree Nation, Tipiwain Prairie Dene First Nation, and Athabaskan Chipewyan First Nation demanded Environment Minister Jim Prentice provide emergency protection for herds on their traditional territory. A 12-year-old boy has entered the Pepsi Refresh Everything contest to win money to build a playground in Attawapiskat. He is Wesley Prankard and lives in southern Ontario, and he visited the community and noticed the lack of infrastructure for kids.
I was in Attawapiskat not too long ago, and we were just, looking, meeting the people, looking at the problems that True North Aid could help with. And I noticed that the kids didn't have anywhere to play. They would play on the streets, and they didn't have any playground. So that night, we were just talking over the problems, and I told my mom and dad that they didn't have one and that I wanted to do something about that. So that's how we got to the conclusion that we're going to build one.
Wesley was with his family delivering aid to the community for charity organization True North. Bob Prankard is Wesley's proud father.
It's pretty amazing that someone so young can have a heart to do. But I guess what strikes me about that is that how kids don't know what's not possible, and that's something that we really want to foster in our own kids. But then, kids in the north and in northern reserves, I think that potential is there as well.
The Pepsi Refresh Everything contest has 300 different charity projects, which people can vote for up to 10 favorites every day. Voting ends August 31st. A former Nipissing University student is sending back his diploma to protest the naming of the library. Amidst controversy and protest, the university went ahead and named its new library after former Ontario Premier Mike Harris. First Nations were not happy with the naming because of Harris's role in the Iprawash incident. That was when Dudley George was shot and killed in Iprawash Provincial more than 12 years ago when he and other community members were protecting a burial site. Ron Fisher just doesn't understand why the university would make that move.
Being an alumni from Nipissing, I was kind of interested they would take that, the university would take that stand with all the controversy about it. Like, there's so many things that he did in his, I don't know if you'd call it a legacy or a negacy, negative. But then he, with the nurses, the teachers, welfare, I don't know how many other social programs and things like that. And for Anishinaabeg people, the Dudley George incident. So, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me to do something like that, name a library after Mike Harris.
Not only is Fisher returning his diploma, he's also attaching a copy of the Iprawash Inquiry Recommendations Report. The Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business is looking for nominations for its next round of inductees into the Aboriginal Business Hall of Fame. Angela Bishop, a director of programs with CCAB, says they're looking for a few key things in the nominations.
The first is business leadership and excellence, and we look for a history of that over the long term, demonstrating entrepreneurship and forward thinking. For example, Chief Judith Sayers from 2009 ensured that the environment was a top concern in her business endeavor. The second thing is contribution to community. That is something that's clearly demonstrated by all of the laureates, is a long-term commitment to communities. The late Susan Rochon, for example, was the first owner of a radio station, and she also made her mark as an advocate for Aboriginal arts and culture, establishing the Aboriginal policy at TVO. The third thing is commitment to building capacity, embracing new technologies while remaining committed to traditional ways is an important part of sustainable development. Garfield Flower from Labrador is a good example of that. He was sometimes the largest employer in his community for the phone company to put service in place, connecting his community to opportunities outside and supporting the partnerships that flow through greater engagement. The final thing we look for are some numbers, measurable results to understand the economic impact of our business leaders. So jobs created, dollars invested, etc. But we know that a lot of the impact from our laureates' work can't be measured, especially their impact as role models, champions for change, and whether or not they are entrepreneurs or leaders in business.
The deadline for nominations is September 30th, and the jury will make its selections early in November. Then new inductees will be notified. The National Aboriginal Firefighters Competition is on this weekend in BC. The firefighters in the competition are from across Canada who have moved on from their regional competitions. The Atlantic region will be represented by Pictou Landing First Nation, Fond du Lac will represent Saskatchewan, Norway House will represent Manitoba, Gatineau will represent BC, Musquashies will represent Alberta, Walpole Island will represent Ontario, Chisabi will represent Quebec, and Nunavut has a team with members from throughout the territory. The teams will compete in many events, including stretcher rigging, firefighter survival, primary search and rescue, and auto extrication. The winner of last year's competition was Team Quebec, which was held in Listigouche, Quebec. The next round of voting is about to begin for the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards. Derek McCorrister is the Director of Operations for the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards. He says the five-year-old awards show has been growing every year.
The awards have taken a huge leap right now. We started initially with online voting. I believe it was 12 categories. And right now we're sitting at about 30 categories. And we have an online membership of over 40,000 voters worldwide. So, you know, the festival has grown.
Voting for nominees has just wrapped up, but you can still cast your vote in the final round for your favorite artist. Final round voting begins August 25th and runs until October 6th. The Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards will be held November 5th in Winnipeg. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
How do you mark a no man's path? A trail, a puff of smoke, I'm looking for my ancestors. I heard they walked this way. Way high up. Musky buffalo. Will I find them in the churches or find them in the schools? I'm looking for my ancestors. I heard they lost their way. Way high up. Step or heard a fiddle play. I feel like I know this land. I feel like I've been here before. I think I found my ancestors. I know they dance this way.
Andrea Menard with Ancestors. And speaking of which, the community of Batchewana First Nation in Ontario is celebrating the return of theirs. The community has held a repatriation ceremony August 19th to welcome home ancestors returned from the Smithsonian Institute. Here's Batchewana Chief Dean Sayers. He spoke with Bomsida August 18th, the day before the celebrations.
Batchewana First Nation is part of a process which will see the return of some of our ancestors that were removed from our area, our territory, back in the late 1800s. And the ceremony that we're going to be providing tomorrow, conducting, is part of a dream of our elders. It's to really celebrate the return of these ancestors. Our elders met a number of years ago now, and at that time said, we need to bring them home. And so through ceremony and through discussions and through action plans with the Smithsonian and the Sioux Tribe of Chippewa Indians, we were able to see this come to fruition tomorrow. So we're pretty excited about bringing them home. The repatriation process will end tomorrow afternoon at our traditional burial ground in the mission, which is about 45 minutes northwest of Sault Ste. Marie. About 11 a.m., we're going to be down at the waterfront in Sault Ste. Marie at Bellevue Park, where we're going to be ending our journey across the river from the United States. And all the remains of all six of those ancestors of ours will come across in a specially made birch bark canoe. And we're going to be celebrating with our people there, and then we'll be celebrating again after our feast in Gooley after the burial. It's pretty exciting day.
I bet it is. And I also have a whole bunch of questions about the repatriation of the ancestors' remains. Do you or anybody in the community know who those people were?
The verification largely took place through some of the work of the Smithsonian and interviews with our elders, but on the most part it was evidence that was found within the journals of representatives of the U.S. Army. And it and was in collections, those documents that they referenced Batchewana. And they were, there are documents that show where, to some degree, that they were taken from. And even reference to a particular spot, Batchewana Village. So they were... with some certainty recognized as Chippewa Indians from the Sault Ste. Marie area, more than likely the Whitefish Island area downtown Sault Ste. Marie, but at the same time there was one that was taken from Batchewana Village.
And what do you mean by taken?
I guess they sent a guy over here. The remains were collected by U.S. Assistant Surgeon Dr. Joseph, 1875, and they had to have been dug up. That's what we figure. They weren't recent graves. They were graves that, on the most part, were between 50 and 100 years, but one was only about 10 years old. So they were probably deaths that took place somewhere in the late 1700s. And by the time they dug them up and they in 1875, they were already possibly up to 100 years old. And then since then, it's been another 130 years since then. So a couple, it's really hard for us to, our elders don't have any recollections of any particulars around the deaths of those individuals, what's happening, nor were they aware of any theft of remains in the 1870s. So we're not sure how they would have done it without us knowing. I guess they might have did it at under cover of night, but I don't have that information.
When did the repatriation process start, and what did it all entail?
Well, I guess... it was the Sioux Tribe of Chippewa Indians back in the early part, 2000, 2001. The Sioux Tribe of Chippewa Indians were going through a repatriation process with regard to some of the ancestors that were taken from the other side of the river here. And it was brought to their attention by the Smithsonian that there was some remains that were affiliated with Batchewana First Nation, or the First Nations on this side of the river, Garden River, Batchewana. And that's approximately 2002, somewhere in there. And then about 2004, 2005 is when there was actually a more formal relationship struck, and we began the process of trying to have them repatriated and under Chief Vernon Surrett back in those days. And we started to meet with our elders, and then I came on in 2005, meeting regularly at least in 2004, 2005 with some of the verification exercises, with some of the review of documents. Actually took representatives of the Smithsonian out on our lands to see how we buried people, where the burial grounds might have been. I guess educating the Smithsonian, which would lend some insight into some of their verification processes. And in 2008, a group of us went to Washington and we conducted ceremony after the verification was complete. To a large extent, we completed the verification. And we, as per spiritual ceremonies, we made commitment to those ancestors that we were bringing them home. And then we commenced more work at this end to see the finalization of that repatriation, including the posting in Lobia 60 days prior to this, at least, that asked if there was any other possible claims that's part of the Smithsonian's process. And, everything was able to receive the green light, and we were able to see them come home. It was a fairly arduous, lengthy process.
That was Dean Sayers, Chief of Batchewana First Nation. Ron Fisher is returning his diploma to Nipissing University over the name of its new library, which is a legacy many don't wish to remember. The university in Ontario named its new library after former Ontario Premier Mike Harris. Many in the Anishinaabeg community were pretty upset by this because of Harris's role in the Iprawash incident. That was when Dudley George was shot and killed in Iprawash Provincial Park more than 12 years ago when he and other community members were protecting a burial site. Now here's Ron Fisher.
And being an alumni from Nipissing, I was kind of interested that they would take that the university would take that stance, and with all the controversy about it, like there's so many things that he did in his I don't know if you'd call it a legacy or a negacy, a negative. But then he with the nurses, teachers, welfare, I don't know how many other social programs, things like that, and just for Anishinaabeg people, the Dudley George incident. So just doesn't make sense to me to do something like that. Name a library after Mike Harris.
So probably one of the biggest issues is the Iprawash incident 13 years ago, right? And his hand in that while he was premier. And I just learned that you have a diploma from Nipissing University and you're planning on sending that back to them. And can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I've got a Bachelor of Education from 1994 that I got from Nipissing, and it was a very proud moment to get it, but not so much of a proud moment now after this, and also after his the honorary degree that they gave Mike Harris. So my intention was, when I first started the Facebook group, I posted that if they do name it after him, I'd send it back. And when the announcement came yesterday afternoon, then I just made a decision and started making arrangements to have it sent back, because I don't want it anymore. It doesn't mean all that much to me. Not a proud moment to have it now. I'm slightly ashamed now, almost. So it's going back. And what they do with it, I'm not worried about, but I really don't want it anymore.
So if you were going to school there now, let's say, how do you think you'd be feeling about the whole situation?
Oh, if I was in school there now, well, I'm sure it would be a lot different. I don't know if any students may even look at a transfer or not, but yeah, I can't see, being pleased even going into the library. Probably do more online research than visiting the library and that, but probably join with the other students and still do, what we can do as students and alumni to, I don't know if you can deter the naming still, but yeah, I say it wouldn't be too enjoyable going into the library as a student there.
What do you think that the Nipissing University will do with your diploma, or when they get back?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know if they still have paper files on from '94 or not, but they can just throw it in my file in the archives. But it doesn't really matter to me.
Will you also be sending a copy of the Iprawash Inquiry recommendations with your diploma?
Yeah, actually, that will be joining my diploma when it gets dropped off next week.
And why is that?
Well, just a reminder of the library and Mike Harris' legacy, and just all that he did during his terms.
That was Ron Fisher, an Anishinaabeg Nation citizen and former student of Nipissing University.
Straight as a crow flies high, yeah. Drifting on the morning sun. Way too long I've been gone, strumming six strings, finding new things to sing about. Time moves slowly when you're lonely, waiting on the one that you love. Coming home, like go ahead, boy, find your dream. I'll be right here waiting on you. Go ahead, boy, I believe in you and all that you do. No longer for your
flying high on the memories that you bring. Count on me, special delivery, prepaid and right on time. Can't wait, won't hesitate. You set me free and let me be me, you do. So go ahead, girl, wait for me. I'll be right back, strumming love on you. Go ahead, girl. That's right, I said true.
That was J.C. Campbell with Go Ahead. The Canada Council for Aboriginal Business is looking for nominations for its next round of inductees into the Aboriginal Business Hall of Fame. Angela Bishop is the Director of Programs with the CCAB, and she says there are many categories to enter your nomination. Plus, there are a number of things the jury panel looks at when considering the nominations.
We are in the process of sorting through applications for the Aboriginal Hall of Fame. This is a program that was initiated in 2004 with the first awards presented in 2005. You know, and it came about through conversations between the leadership of CCAB and conversations with our members, our partners, and Aboriginal communities about the importance of recognizing Aboriginal business leadership because of the opportunity to provide positive role models for the community, particularly for entrepreneurs and youth, whether or not they're planning to pursue a career in business or another area.
And when sorting through those nominations, what specifically are you looking for?
Well, there are four key things that we look for in our nominations. The first is business leadership and excellence. And we look for a history of that over the long term, demonstrating entrepreneurship and forward-thinking. For example, Chief Judith Sayers, who is a laureate from 2009, ensured that the environment was a top concern in her business endeavors. The second thing is contribution to community. That is something that's clearly demonstrated by all of the laureates, is a long-term commitment to communities. Susan Rochon, for example, was the first Aboriginal owner of a radio station, and she also made her mark as an advocate for Aboriginal arts and culture, establishing the Aboriginal policy at TVO. The third thing is commitment to building capacity, embracing new technologies while remaining committed to traditional ways is an important part of sustainable development. Garfield Flower from Labrador is a good example of that. He was sometimes the largest employer in his community for the phone company to put service in place, connecting his community to opportunities outside and supporting the partnerships that flowed through greater engagement. The final thing we look for are some numbers, some measurable results to understand the economic impact of our business leaders. So jobs created, dollars invested, etc. But we know that a lot of the impact from our laureates can't be measured. So their impact as role models, champions for change, and whether or not they are entrepreneurs or leaders in business.
I know that you shared some of the people who have gone into the Hall of Fame. What are some examples of some other businesses and leaders?
Each year, we look to induct two Aboriginal business leaders into the Hall of Fame, and they represent businesses from Labrador to BC and all points in between. Many of the laureates have been involved with community economic development groups or own their own businesses, and they're also just as likely to work in mainstream Canadian business. For example, Ron Jameson from Six Nations Grand River Reserve worked with the BMO, where he established 15 community branches and, I think, really importantly, spearheaded in home ownership initiatives in Aboriginal communities. Ron's also been on the CCA board over two decades, and though some are retired, we still see him at our offices chatting about the future of Aboriginal business here in Canada.
Okay, and about typically how many nominations do you receive every year?
Generally, we receive close to a dozen nominations each year. We, at the CCAB, we do a review of those nominations. We check references, and then we forward them to a jury that's chaired by Jack McDonald, the CEO of ESS, that is the business sponsor of this program. And they have a really tough job this year, as they have had in the past 6 years in making the selection. And the nominations that aren't granted in any given year are generally held over for consideration in subsequent years.
Okay, and I understand that you're looking for nominations, and when does that deadline close?
Nominations is September 30th, and the jury will make its selections early in November. Shortly after that time, we will notify the new inductees, because one of the really cool things about this recognition program is that for each inductee, there's this great little video produced, and I'd encourage all of your listeners to find their way to the CCAB website and take a look at those videos. It's great personal stories and a little bit of history of Aboriginal communities contained in each. And it also gives anyone who's interested in nominating someone a really good idea of the type of individual that we're looking for, the type of individual that we think serves as a good role model for young people and all the entrepreneurs across Canada.
That was Angela Bishop, Director of Programs at the Canada Council for Aboriginal Business. Wesley Prankard is a 12-year-old boy from Southern Ontario, and he wants to build a playground for the Nanawapiskat First Nation, and he's entered a charitable idea contest with Pepsi to win money for his idea. Here's Wesley.
We are in a contest sort of thing, where we put up our charity idea and people vote on which ideas they think are the best. And so first and second in place get $25,000. And right now I'm actually in first place.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. And Wesley, can you tell me why you want to build a playground in Attawapiskat?
Well, because I was in Attawapiskat not too long ago, and we were just, looking, meeting the people, looking at the problems that Choose a Kid could help with, and I noticed that the kids didn't have anywhere to play. They would play on the streets, and they didn't have any playground. So that night, we were just talking over the problems, and I told my mom and dad that they didn't have one and that I wanted to do something about that. So that's how we came to the conclusion that we're going to build one.
So how did it make you feel that you didn't see any infrastructure for kids in the community?
Well, it just made me feel really sorry for them. I can't believe that they don't get to have all the fun that we have.
And did you talk at all with them about not having a playground or other, even like a skateboard park to them? Did you talk about that?
We did talk to Rosie. She is a friend of ours in Attawapiskat about the project. So she's the one that we talked to.
Wesley's father's name is Bob, and he couldn't be happier his son is moving on his idea.
You know what? It's pretty amazing that someone so young can have a heart to do. But I guess what strikes me about that is that, how kids don't know what's not possible. And that's something that we really want to foster in our own kids. But then, kids in the north, in northern reserves, I think that potential is there as well. And as they feed off of each other, like Wesley has made some very good friends in Attawapiskat, and you know, as they feed off each other, I think it's real inspiration not only to us as adults, but other kids. You know, they've got the whole world in front of them, and that's what's going to change things. It's got to start with the kids.
And what were you doing in Attawapiskat for Wesley to find this out?
Well, it's kind of a long story that goes back. Actually, not too far. Last year, Christmas, we were contacted by a lady in Manitoba, actually, who was collecting some goods and clothing, and wanted help getting it up there. And at the time, we had never heard of Attawapiskat. Most of our work had been much further north and in northern Russia. And so we did a little research and saw, you know, the great homeless problem and some of the living conditions. And it was really to the point where it became, to me anyway, unbelievable that the conditions existed in Canada and, you know, even more so in Ontario, in our own backyard. And so we made a first trip just to, you know, a fact-finding trip to meet some people, you know, the chief and deputy chief and a lot of the elders. And just to hear their stories, and what we found was, you know, all of the stories were true. And so we as an organization committed to help in any way that we can. And that's really how Wesley came into the picture. After we brought back some of the photos and the stories, he really took this on as his own project. And he actually camped out in March to raise money and awareness for them. And in doing so, raised close to $6,000, and that's what led to his trip up there. Air Quebec actually heard about what he did and offered him a free flight up to meet the people he was helping, and they were very kind that way, and they actually helped us ship about 12,000 pounds of goods for free. So that's really how it all started, and the saga continues.
How did you find out about the Pepsi Refreshes Everything project?
Well, I think it must have been last year, watching the Super Bowl. They launched this program in the States. And, you know, we were looking at some ways as an organization to raise funds and awareness for what we're doing. And I thought that would be a great idea. And so logging on to Pepsi's site, we found out it was just an American competition. And kind of squashed things. But in the process, I had signed up, you know, on Twitter and as a friend on Facebook to Canada. And they actually, I guess it was this spring, they announced that it would be coming to Canada. And Wesley jumped all over it. You know, he said, hey, this can help us build a playground. And so, you know, we set him up with the page and went from there.
So I understand that voting is going on right now at the project, and how much longer is the votes going to stay open?
Voting ends at the end of this month, October 31st. For most of the month of July, he was in first place, which was great. And but just the last week or so, he dropped to third. And we've been fighting to get him back, and just few moments ago, he went back into first place, and so we're going to fight hard to keep him there for the rest of the 2 weeks.
That was Bob Prankard and his son Wesley, who have entered a charitable idea contest to win money to build a playground at Attawapiskat First Nation in North Ontario.
Rises planted from seeds, beautiful babies, my fruitful lover. Our roots still grow through the concrete of the times. Never underestimate the power in numbers. Oh yes, we grow. Rain feeds our souls. We'll let the sun shine in, let the sun shine in. Chanting it out, my uprising girl. She let the sun shine in, she let the sun shine in.
seeking the truth. Pass our roots to the youth. They aim for the sky till they soar. The world is not to fear. We speak and we hear. Warriors rise, the change is now. Oh yes, we grow. Rain feeds our souls, but let the sun shine in. Let the sun shine in. People rise up, say enough is enough. Let the sun shine in, let the sun shine in. We're living in an era where the body and mind are subjected to one-sided propaganda. Poison narratives that are rotten to the root. Comical contrast compared to you. We're not sheep on the hillside grazing. I choose to live up and ride the occasion. Ignore the ones trying to edge on a fight when our truth is our right and our vision is sight. The world's diverse, so wake yourself up. We're sleeping people. It's the people who's caught in the jaws of fixed social cultural cuts. Backwards screens, a waste of thought. Only way us break out of the box or buckets or crabs. It's a lie that's thought. There's only connection, respect, relations. When truth is our right and our vision is sight. Oh, yes, we grow. Rain feeds our souls, but let the sunshine in, let the sunshine in. People rise up, say enough is enough. Let the sunshine in, let the sunshine in. Let the sunshine in.
That was Digging Roots with Let the Sun, and they're one of the contenders looking to snap up the Best Blues CD in the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards. The first round of voting in the nominations has just closed, and soon voting will begin for the final rounds for the awards show. Derek McCorrister is the Director of Operations of the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards, and he says the awards program has been growing since its inception 5 years ago.
We are in the first round of voting right now for the 2010 Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards. The voting started on the 14th of July, and it will end on Wednesday, August 18th at midnight. So the first round of voting will determine our nominees for the 2010 final round of voting. So that's where anyone can log in and cast their vote for their favorite artist to nominate them into the final round of voting, which ultimately will determine our winners, which we'll announce come November.
Okay, and right now, how many nominees are there?
Right now, this year we had approximately about 130 plus artists submit from across North America for various categories for the awards. So right now we're going to be narrowing that down. The nominations, we usually take the top 3 to 5 artists who get the most votes in the categories for the final round of voting. So we're going to narrow it down for the actual nominations for each category, and the final round of voting will open, which will start on August 25th, and that first round of voting will go until October 6th. That's where we'll determine our winners for the 2010 Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards.
And when did the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards begin, and why?
The award's been going now. This is our fifth year, so we've been going for 5 years now. We started the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards as part of the Manitowabe Festival back in 2006. But the awards have taken a huge leap now. We started mainly with the industry with online voting, and I believe it was 12 categories, and right now we're sitting above 30 categories, and we have an online membership of over 40,000 voters worldwide. So, you know, the festival has grown as part of one of the components of the Manitowabe.
How do the artists benefit from an award?
Well, you know, the awards, we are looking at it as a people's music award. So the people are the ones who are buying the music and listening to music. So once an artist submits to the awards, it gives them that credibility of you know, who they are, and we utilize our awards as a platform to, you know, announce an artist to the people. You know, there's a lot of mainstream artists that have crossed over. Some artists crossed over into the mainstream music industry. For example, Shane Yellowbird or or Crystal Shawanda, both have submitted to our awards in years past and are now making that transition to more main music. So our awards have sort of become a platform where we can announce, you know, the artists out there, make the public aware of who they are and these musicians are capable of.
Okay, and I think that's everything for me, but do you have anything else you'd like to say or add, Derek?
Actually, yeah, you know, we're looking at getting more people to, encourage more people to log in and or sign up to become a member and cast their vote. It is free, so just log on to AboriginalPeopleChoice.com, create a membership account, and go in and log in and cast your vote. It's totally free, and the more votes, the better, and there's artist profiles where you can see artists from all across North America, view their artist profiles, and cast your vote today.
And there's also music clips available.
There's music clips, artist profiles, biographies, video clips, all different tour schedules. So there's all different pieces of the artist profile that will give you a background and a history of who they are, where they've gone, and what their upcoming plans are.
That was Derek McCorrister, Director of Operations for the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards. You've been listening to Bomb Siddell with Jennifer Shawasige. Bomb Siddell is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music Aboriginal artists. Bomb Siddell means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomseda.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bomb Siddell.